I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the more compelling books of the season is the debut book from the journalist Seth Berkman. A Team of Their Own, How an International Sisterhood Made Olympic History, tells the story of the unified Korean women's ice hockey team, how it came together, and the meaning on its South Korean, North Korean players, as well as those of Korean background from the United States and Canada. These are players who are thrust together from various backgrounds and how barriers from language to cultural to political were overcome. Mr. Berkman, who joins me now, covered the team for the New York Times, where his work regularly appears, in the run-up to and during the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. He provides insight into the personal relations of the players, as well as the greater meaning that emerged, such as two very different societies coming together with the world watching, not to mention the rhetoric between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Seth Berkman was born in Seoul and raised in New Jersey. His first trip back to South Korea was for last year's Olympic Games. He has been a regular contributor to the New York Times since 2012 and has had his work published in The New Yorker, Spin, ESPN, and sundry other publications. He is a graduate with honors of the Columbia University Journalism School. This new book is published by Hanover Square Press, which is an imprint of Harlequin. The website for more is at sethberkman.com. The Twitter handle is at A Team of Their Own. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Seth Berkman. Mr. Berkman, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
Now, is hockey big in Korea?
Hockey is not big in Korea. In terms of just general sports, baseball, obviously very popular. Taekwondo has always been a big sport in Korea. But ice hockey, both men's and women's, has always been a secondary, very looked down, not, I don't want to say looked down upon, but very unpopular sport in Korea amongst the populace.
Yeah, and so the reason that Korea had a team in the Olympics was because they were hosting it, and I guess I didn't know this, I'm not a big sports fan, that if you are hosting the Olympics, you get an automatic berth, right?
That is correct. So in 2011, South Korea was awarded the 2018 Winter Olympics, and in the Winter Games, hockey is a really showcase kind of centerpiece event. So South Korea obviously was thrilled to be hosting the Games, but quickly realized we need to create hockey teams in time for the Olympics in 2018, so that presented a bit of a problem for them.
And then you tell the story in the book about how these players come together. What's fascinating is they all come from different backgrounds, and they have a unique relationship to the sport. What did the South Korean say, the authority there in terms of hockey, what did they determine in terms of what they needed for players?
Right. So the governing body for ice hockey in South Korea is the Korea Ice Hockey Association. In the U.S., it's USA Hockey, and Canada, it's Hockey Canada. So the Korea Ice Hockey Association, which I'll refer to as KIHA from here on out, they knew that they needed to build teams, particularly a women's team. In men's hockey, there is a professional league in Asia called the Asia League, where a few teams are based in Korea. That's mostly for you'll see a lot of guys, not only Koreans, Japanese players in that league, but Canadians, Americans who were never quite NHL level, NHL caliber, who still want to play professionally and make a decent salary, so they'll go to the Asia League. There was no league like that for the women's team to kind of pluck players from. And so what KIHA did was one of their public relations workers went online and Googled every Canadian college that had a women's hockey team, looked at the rosters, and if there were names that sounded Korean, if the rosters had photos of players and the photos maybe looked Korean,
yeah.
Basically, KIHA reached out to them and said, are you interested in playing for Korea in the 2018 Olympics? And when some of these young women received these emails, they either thought they were being pranked or it was just spam that they had received.
Yeah. And so is that normal practice? Say other countries, do they do that in terms of seeking players, not just in hockey, but in other sports, say?
You do see it happen in other sports. Kind of the most popular example is, for example, women's basketball. Mm-hmm. A lot of WNBA players still play overseas in the winter just because they can make so much money playing abroad. And so they'll go to Russia or Turkey, countries like that. And occasionally you will see those countries go to a player and basically ask if they would be interested in getting a passport, getting citizenship, and playing for that national team. These are the kind of WNBA players that maybe are all-star level, but maybe a level below, but are still very good players and necessarily wouldn't be on the radar to play on USA Basketball's Olympic team. But for a team like Russia or Turkey, they would be a star centerpiece player. And so you do see other countries occasionally recruit and offer Americans or players from other countries passports to represent their national team to try to get them into the Olympics.
And so the Canada and the United States, are those the only two countries that were from where they had to import players, say?
From what I've understood and all the discussions I had with folks from Kiahan around the team, they specifically were looking at if they could find any Korean-American, Korean-Canadians, just because of the popularity of the sport in terms of women's ice hockey in those two countries.
And I understand from Canada, from where I'm speaking to you from today, one of the players, wasn't one of them on Degrassi?
Right, so that was Caroline Park, and growing up, Caroline was a child actress, and so she was on Degrassi for a couple seasons and also did TV commercials for Nike, Robitussin, and I believe appeared on a couple other kind of teen or children's TV shows, but once she went to college, she kind of put the acting behind and focused on playing college hockey at Princeton University.
And so your part in the story, I mean, you were covering this for the New York Times, were you not?
Yes, originally the way I kind of found out about the team and got in contact with the team was it was a story I was writing for the Times. This was back in late 2016, early 2017, and at the time the focus was going to be on how Korea had sought out these what came to be known as import players to boost their ranks in time for the Olympics.
And so you followed the story through to Pyeongchang, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, and then obviously afterwards and now a team of their own. When did the idea of a unified North and South Korean team come about, and who was responsible for that? Because I remember those of us who, I mean, I don't, as I said earlier, I don't follow sport, but I remember hearing about this in the news when, I guess, was it Kim Jong-un? Was it his idea, say?
It wasn't necessarily his idea. He was kind of the nucleus to make this all happen when it did. There were actually discussions the summer before in 2017 about the possibility of a unified hockey team, and that came about because in South Korea they had recently named a new minister for sports and culture. And the reason he kind of came about was, if you remember the year before, South Korea impeached their president, and one of the scandals that the former president had kind of got entailed in or tied up in was she had blacklisted people in the arts in South Korea who were criticizing her and kind of negatively speaking out against the government. So you had this list of, I think it was 940 artists or so who were blacklisted by the government. And so that minister was eventually pushed out along with the president. So a new sports and culture minister comes on, and in one of just his first interviews, he kind of casually mentions to the press, oh, yes, it would be a great thing for the upcoming Olympics if there was a unified hockey team with players from North and South Korea. And that caught everybody off guard, really. The players on the team had never heard about that, the coaches, but even really the South Korean public. And so it became a big story in South Korea during the summer of 2017. And so the rumors about this abounded for a few weeks. And you had the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, even President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, saying, yes, this would be a great idea that we would support. Eventually that talk died down over the next few weeks, and it seemed to just, you know, go away. The players didn't think too much about it afterwards. But then January 2018, New Year's Day, Kim Jong-un goes on state-run North Korean television and gives his annual New Year's Day speech. And within that speech, he announces he would like to send North Korean athletes to the upcoming Winter Olympics, which were only a month away at that point. Mm-hmm. And this really caught South Korea by surprise, but also they they became very eager to make this happen. As we all, a lot of your listeners, and I'm sure a lot of people remember, the months before the 2018 Olympics were filled with rhetoric and boasts and threats coming from Kim Jong-un, Donald Trump in the United States, and I think a lot of people, not only on the peninsula but around the world, worried that a conflict was possible between North Korea and the U.S., and in between, you had South Korea trying to play peacemaker with both sides. So for Kim Jong-un to offer this olive branch, in a way, they wanted to do anything they could to make this happen and not make the Olympic Games a source of conflict in any kind of way. So the South Korean government, Kiha, they scrambled to kind of see where this could happen, and the obvious kind of solution was the women's hockey team. It's a team sport, so you can add players on. That is correct in a way. Uh-huh. But, for example, if it was figure skating, you can't just all of a sudden throw six North Korean figure skaters into the program. There's timing and different issues. Hockey seemed like a sensible choice, but when it boils down to everything, the women's hockey team was chosen because they were the women's hockey team. The men's hockey team was never considered, and a lot of that just stems from the way South Korea still is when it comes to not only women's sports, but in general, the perception of women, their roles in Korean society, and a lot of the players on the women's hockey team felt not only very used, but angry that they could be sacrificed in such a manner.
Yeah, you talk about that in the book, the differences that the female athletes had, as opposed to, say, the male athletes, and it's a fascinating insight into that society, and into their experiences throughout the games, and before the games even. I'm skipping about here because there's so much in your book that I want to cover. Just how good were the North Korean players?
That was another reason why the South Koreans were not too thrilled about this idea of the unified team. They knew that they were much more skilled, better players than the North Koreans. The two sides would play each other every year or so at either World Championship tournaments, or every few years there's an event called the Asian Winter Games, which are almost as prestigious on the continent as the Olympics. So it's a big event, and in the recent meetings, South Korea had won pretty easily, and they knew that the North Korean players just were not as good as them, essentially. And not only would you be bringing on these players, but you have to teach them your playbook, your systems. Originally, too, the South Koreans thought, okay, if this is going to happen, they're going to maybe add 3-4 new players. The IOC, in their declaration of creating a unified team, added 12 players. Huh. So you had 12 players being added to the locker room, and the IOC also demanded that every game at least 3 North Koreans had to dress. So that meant that 3 South Korean players, who always thought all along they'd be in the Olympics, would not dress for games to make room for the 3 North Koreans who had to be in there on the bench every game in the Olympics.
So there are obviously tensions going into the games. You write about, say, initial meetings and the sort. And the other thing that I was just thinking about was we tend to overlook that. There are communications problems between, say, the North and the South players, as well as the imports, right?
Correct. So the import players, the players from Canada, the Korean-American or Korean-Canadian players, a majority of them did not speak Korean. Caroline was actually one of the players that was a bit fluent in Korean, but the rest of the imports really did not. And so that wasn't too big of a barrier when it came to practices, just because the South Koreans would use English terms or English hockey terminology when they were practicing. But when the North Koreans come in, not only do the North Koreans not speak English and the import players not speak Korean, but the North Koreans used a completely different vocabulary when it came to hockey than the South Koreans did. For example, if they were skating and a North Korean player wanted to receive a pass, she would say, essentially, contact me in Korean, which a South Korean player didn't understand. They would just say, pass me the puck, but the North Korean would say, contact me. So you had this different lexicon, and so essentially they created a makeshift dictionary with the North Korean term for a word, the South Korean term, and the English word. So all these components could try to get on the same page when it just came to even practicing and being together on the ice.
You chronicle in the book, and it's really beautiful, the sort of connection that then evolves amongst the players. And so as someone who was there, you would see this, right, and as you were covering the team?
Yeah, at first the icy walls between the two sides were evident, and then talking to players from the South Korean side at the time, they were not happy even in the first few weeks of this unified team existing. I remember one of the first stories to come out after the North Koreans joined the team was the two players on the North Korean side had birthdays, and so there were these photos of them receiving birthday cake and the whole team singing happy birthday to them as they blew out their candles, and it looked like this fun moment of team bonding. And then later, the South Korean players informed me that these were basically staged events. They had no idea it was the North Korean players' birthdays, and they knew it was just a photo op to kind of push out to the world. A lot of the early interactions between the team, the North Koreans were surrounded by Olympic officials, North Korean government officials who were keeping a watch on them the entire time. Mm. So any kind of interaction or conversations they had, the South Koreans or the imports just felt like these are very canned, almost propaganda responses that we're getting. They would always thank the great leader after anything that they said. There was one player on the South Korean side, Hae-in Ko, and she said she knew whenever a North Korean player was going to enter the vicinity, because if she was just in the team lounge or in, you know, a public space and a television was on, someone would rush in and shut off the TV because the North Koreans were coming and they couldn't be consuming or be around any kind of information or news or media that wasn't coming from North Korea. So not only were the South Koreans upset and angry at the time, but even if they tried to form bonds or some kind of closeness with the North Koreans, it was just very hard, just kind of the circumstances that were going on around them. Eventually, as the team practices and is able to spend more time together and kind of get moments away from all the watchful eyes around them, they are able to build closer relationships. One story that I think really kind of exemplifies this is there was one player, Kim Eun-young, from North Korea, and she became close friends with Marissa Brandt, who was an import from Minnesota. Uh-huh. And Marissa is a super sweet, kind girl. She's friendly with everyone, and so naturally this girl latched onto that from North Korea. And so every morning she would run down and give Marissa a hug, and then at some point during the day she'd ask to see Marissa's phone. And Marissa would hand her phone, and she could tell that the girl from North Korea didn't know how to unlock it, didn't know even how to kind of handle or use the phone, but she would communicate that she would want to see Marissa's album of photos. Mm. So Marissa would bring up her photo album on her phone, and then this North Korean player, for 10 minutes or so, would just almost be in a trance, staring at the photos of Marissa with her friend. She would want to see Marissa around people that cared about her. And looking at this, Marissa just always kind of wondered, you know, what is she thinking about? Is she imagining her life, you know, if it was different if she wasn't in North Korea, as well as trying to get a glimpse into my life as well? So mm-hmm. Eventually, over time, you did start to see more deeper kind of emotions evolve between the two sides, involving the two sides.
Did you, throughout your covering the team, did you have any interaction with the North Korean players?
I did not personally, so that was difficult. And one of the reasons why was, so even to get a media credential for the Olympics, you have to apply about two and a half years in advance.
Right.
The idea for writing this book didn't happen until about a year, less than a year before the Olympic Games. It was too late to get a credential. I was able to get tickets to all the games. That's how I witnessed all the games. And I was talking email, phone, text with some of the South Korean players during the Olympics. But even during media access, practices, and games at the Olympics, the North Koreans were not made available. Mm. So the majority, mostly all the anecdotes or stories of the North Koreans came from the South Korean players on the team. Yeah. One kind of interesting aspect, though, of my experience at the Olympics was one of the tickets that I bought for the second game when Korea played Sweden. It ended up being in a section with the North Korean cheerleading squad, if you remember.
Yeah.
It became a big spectacle at the Olympics because you had these North Korean cheerleaders appearing everywhere and everyone was mesmerized and drawn to them, not least of which because it's like we're witnessing people from North Korea.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting there about a half hour before the game against Sweden starts and no one's sitting around me. And I think it's kind of weird because it's a sold-out game. And then the cheerleaders start marching in and filling in all the seats around me. Eventually, an Olympic official comes over and says, you kind of have to move from the seat. And I got it. I wasn't going to make a big hissy fit about it. So I moved over to the next section. But as I moved, another person, a ticket holder, would come, and I'd be sitting in their seat. So after the third or fourth time, I was getting kind of flustered. So I go back to this Olympic official, and I'm like, hey, I bought this ticket. I need to watch this game here. And so my original seat was still open, so they just plucked me back down there. So that entire game I watched surrounded by 40, 50 cheerleaders from North Korea, which was pretty interesting.
Surreal, to say the least, right?
Right.
The other thing, I mean, it's fascinating to get insight into to what North Korea is like, and we get that in your book, because, I mean, it's just a fascinating society that we obviously know very little about and have, say, firsthand interaction with. A lot of people will doubtless read your book and try to glean as to what a unified Korea might look like. And you know, we get a sense of that because of the players and their interactions with one another. From your reporting, do you have a sense of what that might look like, say?
Ooh, that's a really good question. You know, in talking to some folks, for example, I interviewed Scott Howe, who runs an NGO basically based out of Canada, and every year his group takes a trip to North Korea. It's a goodwill trip based around hockey, essentially. So 20, 30 Canadians will go over and play these exhibition hockey games with the North Korean national teams, both men and women. And so Scott has made this trip a couple years, so he's gotten a lot of insight to see what North Korea is like, but also kind of athletics in North Korea. So the women on the national team, they move to Pyongyang and they do get a better quality of life, kind of in a way. It's seen as very prestigious for their families, but they're put up in housing. Sometimes an athlete will even receive a car, and it is looked on as a matter of prestige. I talked to a player there was a player from North Korea who I had read a lot about, and people on the national team knew. She defected from North Korea to South Korea and eventually went from the North Korean national team to the South Korean national team. And she would tell stories of just horrid training conditions where they would have to make their own undergarments, and the outhouses in the wintertime would overflow with feces, and the younger players would have to clean it up. And it just never seemed like they had any kind of, you know, funding to play hockey. So There were, from the current perspective, with the national team now, it does seem like the players there do have a bit better quality of life. But if you look back maybe 20 years ago, it seemed it was just the rawest, kind of most rudimentary conditions that the North Korean players had. In terms of your question about what unification might look like, in following a lot of news after the Olympics and listening to speeches and interviews with President Moon Jae-in, for example, even he says, you know, it would take another 20, 25 years to achieve something close to what people think unification is. I think an interesting parallel that I've seen brought up and heard people talk about is look at Germany and how long it took East and West Germany to kind of get to the point where it is right now. And you have even more, I would say, to work towards when it comes to North Korea, South Korea, just when it comes to GDP and income and even the cultural barriers that the two sides have, and just how much North Korea is isolated and breaking down those walls. Who knows how long that could take? So I think the Olympics and through this unified team, there were glimpses that allowed people to hope and allowed people to dream in a way.
Yeah.
But actually coming together, and you see now how difficult, you know, even getting to the next step is in the denuclearization talks with the U.S. and North Korea. They haven't really made any tangible steps in the past year and a half, and to think to achieve something like complete unification, that seems way far off down the road,
as I mentioned a moment ago, you write about the frustrations that a lot of the players had with what was happening around them and the sort. Did the players themselves, did they have a sense of, say, the political meaning surrounding the team? I mean, they were obviously focused on the sport itself, but I mean, one could see that they were sort of pawns in all of this, weren't they, in a larger narrative?
Right. That was definitely a fear among the players before the unified team even happened. Are we just going to be kind of these puppets? Mm-hmm. And when that idea came up, none of them were very happy about that idea, because even though they weren't the best team in the world, they had been training for the past 4 years at least for this moment when most of them joined the team. You had some players on the team who had been a part of them for 15, 20 years, so they only cared about the hockey and making a strong statement at the Olympics. One of the things that happened when the unified team first came together was at the training facility in South Korea before they went to the Olympic Games. The team was really put in a bubble. So while you did have all these officials around them, media was a bit closed off in a way from following the team, like even South Korean media. So a lot of the players said, we're so focused on learning North Korean terms for hockey, for practicing, for getting them integrated into the team system, teaching them so much that we don't really have that much time to talk to friends and family back home or search our phones for news about what's going on. So it wasn't until they really started to arrive to their games when they saw all the international media and how big of a deal this was to people. In terms of, you know, the whole political aspect, I know during the Olympics, the majority, maybe all the players, did not like that they were seen as, like you mentioned, kind of these political pawns. After the Olympics, I think a lot of them still did not like the idea, mm-hmm. but they started to understand, okay, we were maybe a part of something that was more than just your average everyday Olympic experience, and that maybe people saw what we did and glean something from that you don't always see when it comes to sports. So
you mentioned this briefly in the beginning of the book about your own background. You were born in Seoul. You were adopted to an American family at a very young age. And so going back to Korea for the Olympics, that was your first time back, if you will, right?
Correct, yeah. I arrived in the U.S. about 3 months after I was born in 1982. So I grew up in suburban New Jersey, lived in the New York, New Jersey area basically all my life. And the first trip I took back was for the Olympics. I arrived February 1st in Seoul. And I remember talking to, you know, people I had met along the way, Korean Americans, and even players on the team and most of the imports. Their first time to Korea was going there to train with the hockey team, and they had mentioned experiences like, oh, I remember looking out the airplane window and seeing the mountains outside of Seoul and just thinking, oh, I'm here, I'm home, kind of, in a way.
Yeah.
I actually don't remember. I don't remember experiencing anything like that. There was no big epiphany. There were times when I would be walking around in Seoul or in Gangnam where the Olympic hockey events were taking place and just kind of think, okay, yeah, I'm in Korea, this is pretty cool, but it didn't sink in. I was so focused on following the team and thinking, how am I going to get access to the players, and so much news, and this team really was kind of the epicenter of the international news cycle entering the Olympics, and me knowing I'm going to try to write this book and figure out how all this new news with the North Koreans plays into that, it was just very, you know, single-minded and narrowly focused on trying to fit in the events of the day into this larger story of this book I was going to write.
Is that something, since you've written the books, now that the book's out, that your own story, say, or your own feelings about that, is it something you want to write about later on?
I don't know if I want to write about it. When it comes to writing, I've always been very tentative to kind of include myself. I will say, just personally, in following the team and being on this journey and writing this book, I do feel that attitude, at least personally, towards Korea or the idea of being Korean have changed. Growing up, I was definitely not connected in many or any kind of ways to Korean culture. I didn't eat Korean food. I didn't speak the Korean language. But as I've gotten older and kind of experienced the past few years being around this team, it is more so a source of pride, I guess you could say, where I more strongly identify with being Korean. I still don't speak the language, but there are other aspects than just feeling more Korean. And this was something that I often talked with the import players a lot about, is their sense of quote-unquote Koreanness and how that was constantly changing and evolving during their time on the team.
Yeah, I'm the same age as you, Seth, and my parents are Filipino. I grew up in Vancouver. I was born in Vancouver. And, you know, growing up, it was never, it was never a priority, say, to be Filipino or to even think about it. And I guess once you hit a certain age, it's something that one thinks about and tries to seek out, if you will.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I assume, you know, as I get older, it probably will compound kind of in a way.
Yeah.
And I do see myself, you know, always being more eager to learn more and even visit Korea more often than I had in the past.
A Team of Their Own is such a beautiful book. I mean, there's so many just wonderful moments in the book. I mean, you talk about lighting the Olympic flame. Two players were involved in that, what that was like. There's a scene, I hate to give it away, but near the end of the book where the North Korean players have to go, and it's just such a moving moment in the book. There's a lot of emotion, and I guess sport is like that. I mean, it is often heartbreaking. In terms of getting to write this book, to tell this story as you have, what stood out for you in terms of an emotional moment? I mean, there must have been a few of them for you personally. Were there?
Definitely. One of the moments that really kind of made me a bit angry, I guess you could say, was the first Olympic game was against Switzerland, and Kim Yo-jung, his sister, was in attendance.
Yeah.
President Moon was there. You had all American, you know, government officials,
right,
and Olympic officials, and North Korean cheerleaders were there. And one of the players I had talked to a lot from the South Korean side was the goaltender, Shim So-jung. And So-jung started skating with the national team when she was only 9 years old. She had been a part of this team for about 18 years, and she dreamed of playing in the Olympics even before that was a possibility. And she finally worked her way and was going to have this moment where she heard her name announced, you know, in the Olympics, Shim So-jung, goaltender for Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And they're announcing the starting lineups before the first game, and they're about to get the So-jung name, and that's when President Moon and Kim Yo-jung walk in. So immediately, all the attention just shifts to them walking to their seats, and you don't hear So-jung's name, just the flashing sound of cameras going off. And I thought that must have been such a heartbreaking moment for her to kind of, you know, this is her moment. And as a lot of the team felt, it was taken away by the show going on with all the politics that a lot more people, sadly, I think, you know, I don't want to say sadly to say, but, you know, it makes sense that they were more drawn to that aspect surrounding the team at the time. So.
Yeah. Now, there probably won't be a sequel to this book because the chances of a Korean team making it in 2022 are very small. Is that right?
Yeah, so right now South Korea is ranked about 16th in the world. For the 2022 games, it looks like the IOC is going to make the women's hockey tournament 10 teams.
Mm.
So South Korea right now is about one level below the teams that will be expected to qualify for the Olympics. So it's not out of the realm of possibility, but it would be hard. It's interesting, though, to see if they would ever try to do a unified hockey team again. Like, if South Korea did improve in time for the next game, if they would try to make a unified team, which would bring their level of competition down again. But there are other sports since the 2018 Olympics where North Korea and South Korea have made unified teams. At the Asian Summer Games last year, they had a unified team in women's basketball and a few other sports. And I think the goal is for Tokyo 2020 to also have unified teams. And both countries' Olympic committees are discussing right now putting in a bid to host the 2032 Summer Olympics.
Mm. And you've obviously kept in touch with a number of the players that you write about. What is it like for them to have a book about their experience now out?
Yeah, and so I was just with a couple of players earlier this week. I had a few book tour stops. One was at Yale University in New Haven, where Grace Lee, one of the imports, now plays for the women's hockey team. So it was great to catch up with her. And then the next day I was in Boston with Randy Griffin, another import who lives in the area and also went to Harvard. And so they're excited about it. I think a lot of the players have told me it's great to relive so much of the journey that they were a part. And I think part of it does make them miss the players in South Korea, because all the imports essentially came back to the U.S. or Canada shortly after the Olympics. And a majority of the South Korean players are still there. But I know, for example, Randy Griffin, the import from Boston, her wedding is this weekend, and so three of the South Korean players are coming down to attend her wedding, which I just think is a really cool thing.
Seth, I want to poach on your good nature by asking you another personal question. You mentioned in the acknowledgments, you think of a number of people. One of them is Lillian Ross, and I'm wondering, what was she like?
Lillian was a wonderful person to be around. I met Lillian. So in graduate school, I interned at the New Yorker and then worked there part-time as like a freelancer for a year or so after that internship had ended. But during my time at the New Yorker, my boss, Susan Morrison, she asked me if I would like to help out on a project that Lillian was doing. And so I said, yes, I'd be happy to. And I remember the first day going to Lillian's apartment in Manhattan, and the door was slightly ajar as I arrived, and I could see her sitting at the kitchen table kind of waiting for me. And at the time, she must have been in her early 90s, even by then. But not only super sweet and caring, but just had wonderful stories. I mean, sometimes we wouldn't even do work when I would come to visit her. She would just tell me stories about, Salinger or Hemingway or the tons of different people that she encountered and worked with over the years. And so, yeah, that was one of my most favorite kind of just friendships, I've been able to have as an adult.
Yeah. Did she talk about Mr. Sean?
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, she always, reflecting back, and then even she wrote a book about her relationship with him, and so sometimes we would go over things from that book because it became what eventually was her final book and a lot of reflection on pieces she had done before. So she would talk openly about her personal life and colleagues and different just things she encountered in work and outside of work as well. So.
You'll pardon the indulgence on my part to ask you for stories about that. It's a tremendous book. It's a very fine achievement, as I told you already. It's beautiful passages in the book, A Team of Their Own. What's next for you? I mean, you're still working for the Times, is that right?
Yeah, I'm still doing stories for the Times, covering a bit of women's hockey right now for them, actually. And the next month or so, I'll be going on a few more book tour dates. You can find those at SethBerkman.com, and really focusing on promoting and, doing as many interviews like this one as I can about this book. I'd say till the end of the year, and then the new year comes. There's a couple of things I'm going to look over professionally, hopefully still keep writing sports stories for the Times and such, but we'll see what 2020 brings. Wow, 2020.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's a hell of a good book, and I'm now a fan and can't wait for the next one. I so appreciate your time today, Seth. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Good luck with the book.
This has been great. Thanks so much for your time today.
The website for more is at sethberkman.com. The book is called A Team of Their Own, How an International Sisterhood Made Olympic History. It is published by Hanover Square Press. Its author, Seth Berkman, joined me on the line from New York City in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.